Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman whose intelligence and mastery of important issues in this war for the free world is about second to none, as far as I'm concerned, is Jessica Vaughn. She is the Director of Policy Studies for an indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies, in Washington, D.C. She is a former Foreign Service officer. She writes brilliantly and has been extraordinarily effective in her public appearances, notably most recently last night on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News. Jessica, it's delightful to catch up with you. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Well, the subject of your remarks last night, and something that I think is weighing on all of us, is this very graphic demonstration of the ambition of people south of our border to get across it by hook or by crook, notably this caravan. Talk a little bit about what's that about and why it's so troubling, given that there is no real security along our southern border at the moment.
Well, it is very troubling. Some groups have done smaller versions of this for several years now to try to protect themselves from the many threats to their safety they encounter trying to come through Mexico to try to migrate illegally to the United States. But this one is organized more like a big political stunt. There's an activist group involved. They're billing it as kind of like a walkathon for open borders, saying that they're organizing this group of more than 1,000 people. Some reports say up to 1,500 people who say that they want to walk to the U.S. border and assert their right to come into the United States, and they will do it by taking advantage of our broken asylum system. They all think that they have the right to just show up on our doorstep and claim political asylum and be waved in. And the scary thing is that if the U.S. government doesn't change the way it's handling the cases of people who come and ask for asylum at our border, that we would let them in. I mean, they're certainly under Obama policies, they would be let in.
Yeah, they do have a right, in a sense, though they certainly shouldn't on any other basis.
Well, not a right. And under international law, I think it's important to point out that real asylum seekers are supposed to seek asylum in the first safe country they come to, and that is Mexico. But we've never really enforced that, so.
Well, and neither have the Mexicans, which is really quite extraordinary because they have, as you know better than I, Jessica Vaughn, some of the most fastidious, shall we say, immigration restrictions and enforcement practices of any country. And yet they seem to see it useful to them to just allow these folks to march on through and cross their entire country. What's up with that? And do you think that Donald Trump got the Mexican government's attention by pushing back rather forcefully in some tweets over the weekend?
Well, the Mexican government officially, you know, says that it takes its immigration laws seriously. But I had a conversation with a senior level Mexican immigration official not too long ago, and she told me that really, as long as they think that people are headed for the United States, they see no reason to block them from doing that. You know, even to go so far as to tell people to keep moving to the United States if they think they don't have any money or any family in Mexico. They assume that we're going to take them in, and in recent years, they've been right. But there is a new president now with a new attitude toward our relationship with Mexico and our need to enforce immigration laws. And the president, with respect to this recent event of more than 1,000 people, this so-called caravan coming, has indicated that we're not going to necessarily just let them in. And not only that, that the United States will consider how Mexico handles this bilateral issue when we're working on other bilateral issues like trade, specifically NAFTA. And suggesting that if Mexico is not a good neighbor on immigration issues, then we need to evaluate our trade relationship as well. And that seems to have spurred some action on the part of the Mexican government, because they've come out today and said, well, we're going to break up this caravan now. We're not going to allow this to happen. And they really can't escape the perception that this has something to do with Trump's tough stance on it and saying that they're not going to just walk all over us.
This question occurs, though, whether they'll break them up and send them home or whether they'll simply allow them to move on up north towards our border to get across it individually or in small groups rather than in this one that got a lot of media attention for sure. This brings me to another question, Jessica Vaughn. The president also indicated in these rather testy texts over the weekend that his Twitter feed that he was going to put an end to negotiations on the DACA deal, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. You and I have talked about this a lot over the past year or so, Jessica, but what do you make of the current state of play with respect to this particular issue?
It appears to me that the White House is looking ahead and is worried that the makeup of the House will change enough so that the Democrats could possibly take back the U.S. House of Representatives. And I think they're cognizant that, you know, it may be harder to get agreement on some of these issues if that happens, and that maybe now would be a better time to negotiate something. They're also pointing to this caravan episode and saying, look, you know, there are a lot of other laws that need to be changed as well. And so I think the White House would like Congress to do something on DACA, but I don't think the White House is going to retreat any in their position of this very generous offer that they already made in February for a much larger amnesty and to modest cuts in legal immigration and some really important border security fixes that are now, you know, obviously more important than ever. I'm not sure that the House and Senate Republican leadership see it like that and that they feel any real urgency to do something about DACA. So I think the White House is really subtly pushing this to keep going, but I'm not sure that Congress is going to take them up to that. Some people said they don't think Congress is going to pass another law this year.
Yeah. We'll watch that closely, as we will what's happening on the border. And Jessica Vaughn, again, I can't thank you enough for what you and your colleagues do at the Center for Immigration Studies to really help us understand both the national and homeland security implications of a faulty border security, as well as the lack of real interior enforcement. These are things that have to be fixed, it seems to me, as does what we will be discussing next, port security, especially the idea of turning over some of our key ports to foreign countries known to be associated, among other people, with Saddam Hussein's bomb maker. You can't make this stuff up. Watch this space, folks. Next up, we'll be talking with Professor Dr. Joe King about that subject and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a pleasure to welcome, for I believe the first time, to our Secure Freedom microphones, Dr. Joseph King. He is a very credentialed individual on matters of great concern to us on this program, including having served in the past as the chief of the National Security Section at the Department of Homeland Security's New York office. He has been a supervisory special agent with the U.S. Customs Service in the Treasury Department, responsible for terrorism and the Middle East Division at various points. Also served as a special investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Dr. King is these days an associate professor at John Jay College. He's also a professor at the City University of New York. Dr. King, it is a delight to have you with us. Thank you very much for finding a few minutes for us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm particularly keen to talk with you because in your various professional capacities, you bring an expertise to a topic that is weighing on me a lot, and that is a company called Gulftainer that has managed, it seems mostly through some backroom dark of night dealing with the Obama administration, to take over container port operations in the very strategically located Port Canaveral on the east coast of Florida, and is now poised to do the same in the also strategically located port of Wilmington, Delaware. I'd like to get your thoughts on the company and the advisability of entrusting sensitive activities like these to it.
Well, first of all, the company is very suspicious as to who's behind it, who's funding it. Some of the people associated with it, former Saddam loyalist. And it just doesn't sit right with me to see most of our port operations now, much like England did years ago, trying to sell it to foreign interests. A lot of people don't realize, they don't realize the nuts and bolts of what a port does. They look at it on TV and there's containers coming in and containers going out. But they don't realize that whoever owns that port or controls that port, has a lease on it, has the ability to do whatever it wants to with those containers, whether it's change of invoice from foreign shipment that requires customs to a domestic shipment that doesn't, whether it would be to open the containers and remove items from it, or to put items in it and send it on its way into the heartland of the United States. The importance of the ports is much overlooked in our national security outlook. If you go back in history, you can see one of the main reasons why the Gambino family, the mafia family in Brooklyn, was to seek control of the International Longshoremen's Union was the fact that it controlled the piers. It could then bring in, as it did, many tons of heroin or cocaine in the time when the container, when the ports were not containerized. And everyone said, now the containers are here, we'll cut down on any kind of risk. I think it's the opposite. Now you've increased the risk because it's not one package coming in. It's a 40-foot container house to house, which they can have duplicate seals on to show that it wasn't open. They can have duplicate invoices on. They could ship it out. And you're basically giving all of that security over to a foreign entity. In addition, if you look at some places like Canaveral or Delaware, the strategic positions that they're in would be of great interest to foreign intelligence services. When you look at the operation of the container, you now allow them almost unlimited visas to bring in anyone they want, whether it's an H visa or a B-1, B-2. They can now say, well, there are specialists in port operations or there are specialists in IT operations, and giving them almost a blanket authority to bring in whoever they want without much background information on them.
Yeah, there's so much to drill down in on what you've just said, Dr. Joseph King, and let me just touch on a couple of the key points. The background to this particular company, Gulftainer, is curious, I think it's fair to say. As you mentioned, it's a joint venture between a sheikh based in the United Arab Emirates, which some of us may recall was the nation from which the Dubai Ports World effort was made to take over ports a few years back in this country. This particular joint venture, however, also features a family by the name of Jafar, which, as you said, has had ties not just to Saddam loyalists. I think it's important to note one of the Jafar family members was actually the nuclear bomb maker for Saddam Hussein. And another aspect of Gulftainer's operations, Dr. King, as you know, is that they are associated with a company in Russia that manufactures a special kind of container. And you're right, they could certainly be problematic in a lot of ways. This one most especially so because it has built into it, concealed into it, the so-called Club K device, a secret cruise missile launcher, which has nuclear-capable cruise missiles capable of going in it. Just from a professional point of view, Dr. King, this would seem to me to go beyond just sort of troubling and of concern. This ought to be a national security red flag, don't you think?
I really don't understand why some agency or some committee hasn't picked up this. I know we need, you know, we do need foreign investments, and that's a venue we have to look at. But as you said, the Russians have the K Club, where a 40-foot container just slides up and a missile could be fired. That container could be brought into the country, change the invoice from a foreign shipment to a domestic shipment, and driven right off the piers and driven anywhere in the United States and set to be fired. And it could be just left there for years. I mean, it could be the Trojan horse philosophy.
Indeed. Trojan horse is exactly the way we've described those containers. You're absolutely right.
I just want to say, people don't realize what the container trafficking has done to not just shipping, but organized crime figures, whether it's human trafficking. They found numerous containers full of people coming into the country. Obviously, anyone who looks around can see how much drugs are brought into this country every year. And the fact that customs is terribly on demand, and customs doesn't even look at, I believe the last time they said they looked at like 3%. And when they call it a look, they mean someone looked at an invoice. They do not mean someone went down and opened the container, opened the package to see if it really is shirts. And under some new procedures, if you're a trusted exporter, like from South America, say, of flowers or blueberries from Guatemala, that container can be waved through customs without anyone looking at it. And we now say, oh, we hope that you didn't put cocaine, or we hope that you didn't put a bomb in it, or we hope you didn't do that. And if you look back, there's one case that always troubled the CIA and the FBI years ago, was a container from Egypt that was found in a 40-foot container from Egypt found in Rome or in Italy at a container port, which had a basically what you would call a studio apartment built into the back of it. And an Egyptian known terrorist was in that apartment, living there, waiting for the 10-day trip to Europe, but was caught, but never cooperated, never said anything, and was just sentenced to a prison term. So that container opens up vast worlds to any of our enemies. And the fact that it's going to be controlled by someone like the Jaffa family, it amazes me that someone can go from being on the capture or kill list from the CIA invasion of Iraq to now being a multimillionaire with world connections and owning parts of the United States.
Yeah. And the idea, as I understand it, Dr. King, is that Gulftainer, having established this foothold in first Port Canaveral, Florida, and now if a decision is made Friday, I believe, by the Port of Wilmington, and subsequently confirmed by the legislature of the state of Delaware, they will be able to compete or simply inveigle their way into lots of other ports around this country. And again, we had a very significant debate about the advisability of all of this back during the Bush administration. And it just, as you said yourself, it strains credulity that there isn't some sort of national security mechanism, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States or something, that is raising an alarm about this, as we're trying to do now.
Part of the problem is, too, that, you know, we have a Washington, D.C. full of lobbyists who, in some cases, are former Democratic officials and some Republican officials who are just paid hired guns to go and push these matters through and grease the skids, as we used to say, to make sure this goes through. And the other point is that the hardest part is the first container. Their operations in taking over Canaveral are going to be their credentials for taking over Wilmington, Jackson, Port Newark, and so on and so on. They're a proven manager, and you lease your company to the most successful manager to make the highest profits.
Especially when it's offering, as in the case of Wilmington, apparently something on the order of $518 million in investment and 5,000 new jobs and basically a new container facility. It is tempting, to say the least.
That port, Delaware port, is an amazing deal. And it would be hard to say, if I'm a Delaware official, that we're going to turn this down, because it's almost, you're looking at gift horse in the mouth. There's all kinds of things. And if you look at the Port Canaveral deal and the Port Delaware deal to see how many of this building boom that they will put in are for refrigeration units.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know from trade purposes, you need refrigeration units for fresh flowers, fresh fruit, blueberries, whatsoever. But it's also interesting that many nuclear or biological elements require a refrigerated condition.
Wow. Another chilling thought. If people wish to do us harm, this is a very, very convenient way to do it, for sure. Dr. Joseph King, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for your time today, and I hope that we'll be able to come back to you, especially as this particular story develops. It is vital to have your insights and expertise brought to bear on it, sir. Thank you for the work you're doing these days at the City University of New York and the John Jay College. Keep it up, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman, one of our duty experts on economic warfare, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
It is a delight to say we have once again connected with the great Claudia Rosette, one of our time's most intrepid and accomplished and indeed recognized investigative reporters. She has worked for many years with the Wall Street Journal in both editorial capacities and also as one of its distinguished foreign correspondents. These days, she is with the Independent Women's Forum as a senior fellow and a contributor to both Forbes.com and PJ Media, where she writes brilliant columns on matters of great import, one of which caught our eye. It involves a man who has been designated by President Trump to be his new national security advisor. He is, of course, Ambassador John Bolton. And unlike an awful lot of other prattling going on, much of it from the usual suspects in the establishment media and the chattering classes, she likes John Bolton, as do I. And it's a delight to have a chance to talk with her a little bit about why she thinks he will be a splendid choice for National Security Advisor. Claudia Rosette, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
So you have, of course, had opportunities to observe Ambassador Bolton, notably during his time at that hangout you have long frequented, called the United Nations, where he served as our distinguished permanent representative. Tell us about your insights into both his character and his capabilities and what prompts you to think so highly of him.
Well, a lot of the sort of appalling pictures that are turning up in the mainstream press just really don't have a lot of relation to the Ambassador John Bolton.
Now, for the record, we should say not literally pictures, but portraits of the man.
Yeah, the portraits. The things like the New York Times editorial headline, yes, John Bolton really is that dangerous. Actually, he's dangerous to America's enemies, which is exactly what we need right now. And I have just great respect for him, having watched him at the United Nations, things he did before the United Nations. Basically, he's had a long career, much of it in government at the State Department in Washington and then at the United Nations, working in things like arms control, international organizations, and then at the UN as our ambassador. And over, what he has done is with vision much more clear-eyed than you usually get in diplomacy, looked at what the real issues are, analyzed it, diagnosed it, explained in plain English to people what the problems are. And then he actually has gotten, in many cases, results. This is somebody who actually has a real track record of being able to navigate the bureaucracies, the federal bureaucracy, the State Department bureaucracy, the United Nations bureaucracy, all these things, to get to something. I mean, a really good example is the resolution that the United Nations General Assembly passed in 1975, equating Zionism with racism. John Bolton was the prime figure behind persuading the UN General Assembly to repeal to scrap that resolution, to get rid of it, to take it off the books. That is a very difficult task, to work the UN that well and that effectively.
You know, another one that I was also incredibly impressed by, because of it involved working with a whole host of nations, many of them not necessarily aligned with us, something called the Proliferation Security Initiative. This predated his time in the UN, of course, Claudia, but you've spent a lot of time focusing on bad actors like North Korea, for example, and Iran, countries that have often been able to get access to advanced weapon systems or technologies by covert shipments. And this so-called PSI was designed to try to prevent those sorts of things. Talk a little bit about that and what it says about the man's abilities to be effective in diplomatic circles, among others.
Yeah, he put together a coalition. He came up with the idea for this thing and then put together a coalition of countries where the idea was to interdict illicit shipments by rogue states. And there were a number of pretty spectacular interdictions in the sort of early years of this. Under President Obama, it sort of faded a bit oddly from the scene. You know, the Proliferation and Security Initiative.
Oddly, or it just didn't quite fit his work program?
Yeah, I kept looking for what's it continuing to do, and it became very hard to find, as well as inaccessible. They wouldn't give interviews, but it's still there. Now, they don't publicize everything that they do, so I don't know exactly how active they are at this stage. But it was, when it's used, and it was for countries like North Korea in the early years, it can actually be quite effective at stopping ships from making transfers of drugs, illegal weapons, and so on. So this is a very useful tool that's still out there.
And accomplishment for John Bolton as well. Let me just ask you, Claudia, because the rap that we're hearing is that he's a warmonger. And I'd like your thoughts on this because, among other things, you've actually watched him close at hand and have studied the sorts of work that he's done. But also because this comes at a moment when there seems to be something of a new appreciation for a man who was widely decried for years as a warmonger and a loose cannon on deck and a guy crazed to get his country into any number of conflicts, but who, at least from today's vantage point, clearly was an inspiring, courageous, and desperately needed leader, namely Winston Churchill, the star of The Darkest Hour. So talk about it. I think of John Bolton as something of a Churchillian figure in his way, and much needed as you do, obviously, in this time. Do you think that's an apt analogy?
Yes, it's a parallel I drew in the piece I wrote for PJ Media about him. There's the Neville Chamberlain school where people would say, oh, he's not a warmonger. No, he's trying to appease, in that case, Nazi Germany, and has failed, of course. And Churchill, who was accused of being a warmonger as well in his day, was pointing to some real dangers. And that's exactly the parallel here. In my observation, and if you really read what he has written and listen to what he says, instead of jumping to the conclusion that anyone who mentions war is a warmonger, he's been watching a rising set of threats. It's sort of a network out there, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, their sidekicks, Cuba, Venezuela, Syria, Yemen. You know, there's a lot of trouble in the world today. It's far more dangerous than it was in the aftermath, sort of near aftermath of the Soviet collapse in the 1990s when we had that whole great moment of peace dividend and so on. There really are a rising set of very dangerous challenges. Vladimir Putin brags up next generation nuclear weapons. We don't know exactly what he has, but it's not a good sign that he's boasting that he's got missiles that can defeat our missile defenses and showing videos of striking the United States. China is grabbing turf and putting military bases on islands in the South China Sea, building up its military. North Korea is now closing on missiles with which it can target and thus blackmail and coerce the United, threaten the United States directly, as well as our allies in Asia. There's a whole set of things like this that have been going on. And the point with Ambassador Bolton is that he has been looking at these things and saying, we need to do something. Appeasement is not making this better. It's making it worse. And he has recommended on various fronts, here are things we need to do to address this. I don't think for a minute that he's recommending we start World War III or IV, whatever it would be, just because he loves wars. And what he's pointing to is we have become increasingly vulnerable to attack by increasingly well-armed and predatory and emboldened powers, which took advantage of President Obama's retreat and appeasement and extended hands and flexibility and resets and so on. And we desperately need to reverse that trajectory. We need to reestablish the credibility of America as a deterrent force.
Let's just take that as a fair characterization of what John Bolton brings to the job of National Security Advisor.
He's not a warmonger. He's trying to prevent a truly terrible conflagration.
And why I completely concur with you that his capabilities and his common sense is so desperately needed at this moment. But let's bring this to the particulars. We are now being told there may be a summit meeting in the offing between President Trump and Putin of Russia. When you project what John Bolton will be bringing to the party, can you give us some thoughts as to what he might be saying and recommending in that regard?
Frank, I truly don't know what might take place if the summit takes place at all. In fact, what I would say there is a lot depends on what it is this summit would be meant to accomplish. Okay. If it's simply let's sit down and talk, I don't think it's a very good idea at all. And I'll be very interested to see what actually happens with this as John Bolton actually officially takes up his duties on April 9th and is right there advising the president on what needs doing. If it's a matter of trying to sort out an approach on North Korea, where I think Russia has actually got quite an oar into that whole mess, or Syria, where they were invited, Russia was invited in by President Obama and has now become that's been its portal back into the Middle East.
Claudia, we are well over time. I have to leave it, I'm afraid, at that for the moment, but look forward to visiting with you soon, both with respect to this possible summit and the North Korean one and so much more. But in the meantime, thank you for the great work you do at Forbes and PJ Media and the Independent Women's Forum. You are a national treasure. We value your friendship tremendously. Next up, we will be speaking with Kevin Freeman about economic warfare being waged against the United States by Communist China. And it's not a tariff war, by the way. Stay tuned for more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on matters involving economic warfare. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy with that as his portfolio. But more importantly, he is the star of the upcoming Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. It will be shortly available, and I can't wait, in particular because the subjects that we discuss with Kevin each week and that are the focus of his terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, are going to be, I think, just stupendously interesting to television viewers as well. So we're delighted to have him with us. Kevin, glad to have you around. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing well, Frank. Great to be here.
Good. Well, while you're doing well, it certainly seems as though the global economic warfare business is getting more and more ominous by the day. Let's talk a little bit about the one that is much in the news at the moment, Kevin, and then we'll turn to one that should be, but largely isn't. The first is the tariffs crisis or war, perhaps, in the offing between the United States and China most immediately. Tell us what you think is going on there. Is this much ado about not very much, or is this likely to go seriously south?
Well, these are warning shots. There's no doubt that this could go very serious. And it could happen very quickly. The problem is the president has stated that we're literally being taken advantage of in the world trade system, and there's little doubt that he's right. Other presidents have ignored it, or they've done minor things. And he came and said, look, we're not taking it anymore. We have a massive trade deficit. It's continuing. It's harming our nation. And we're not going to let you continue to steal our intellectual property as well as do dumping and other things. The response was from the Chinese very quickly, well, if you harm us, then we'll attack you. And they came back with their own tariffs on agricultural products primarily. And they said, you know, look, we will match you. This is what it looks like at the beginning of a trade war. Can we avert it? Absolutely we can. Are we in the right on these issues? I believe we are. But there's no doubt that the Chinese were making something out of this, and we're just trying to get back to a more normal trade position.
This brings me to another piece of the Chinese economic warfare agenda, Kevin Freeman. And you've been chronicling it now with great, I think, authority and tenacity for several years at your Global Economic Warfare blog, but also in your writings, Kevin, your two important books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, you've been charting what attacks on the dollar might look like and from whence they might come. And it certainly seems as though there have been some developments in the past few days that are bearing out your warnings in this regard. Tell us about them.
We've long noted that the Chinese, and supported by the Russians, have intended to displace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. They want to replace it with the Chinese renminbi, or the yuan, as it's commonly called. And they've made great strides to doing that. Last week, they took another important step, and they created a futures contract that trades oil exclusively in yuan, which means that anyone who wants to hedge oil, buy oil, transfer oil, can do it. They don't have to use the dollar to do it, and this is knocking one of the big props that's kept the dollar as reserve currency. They knew what they were doing when they did it. They purposed it, and they stated it, and it was remarkably successful because the Chinese are the largest importers of oil at this point.
The concerns about the dollar are not confined to them, of course. So in a way, they're both exacerbating them and certainly capitalizing them on them, aren't they?
They have actually perpetrated across the world a notion that the dollar is a problem, that the U.S. economic hegemony is a problem, that we've got, they've made the case that we've got to stop the U.S. from being the sole financial superpower, and they understand that we've used economic weapons very effectively, both in the war on terror and also to maintain our position in the world. And so they've been convincing other nations to join with them in calling for a pulling down of the dollar, at least pulling it down to a certain degree. And they've gotten a lot of support, and they especially are getting support in Middle Eastern nations.
And Kevin Freeman, this is coming about at a time when the Brits, who are engaged in some very serious back and forth with the Russians in the aftermath of this apparent attack upon a former Russian spy that took place in Great Britain recently, that the Brits may take economic measures against the Russians and specifically their debt. Tell us about that and how this fits into the larger drama.
Basically, one of the responses back to the expulsion of spies and the chemical weapons attack that took place in London, that was a targeted assassination. One of the answers is that Prime Minister Theresa May said, well, we might consider stopping the sale of Russian debt on the London financial markets. Well, this harkens back to a threat that the United States made against the British in the Suez Canal crisis. If you don't go along with what we want, we will stop promoting your debt or purchasing your debt. And it was a threat to the Russians. Well, of course, the Russians respond back and say, well, we should perhaps stop buying American debt. And this is the threat. We're beginning to see an escalation of global economic strategies, warfare strategies. And so when that came out, all it is it's like what you would see happen in slow motion before a world war starts. And we're beginning to see those kind of responses.
You know, you're the second person who has used this analogy in recent days. I believe it was yesterday, as a matter of fact. Gordon Chang was talking about a piece that he'd recently written, I believe, at the Daily Beast, about our times seemingly reminiscent of Sarajevo on the eve of World War I, where these very, very large tectonic shifts are taking place in the geostrategic firmament, if you will, and the consequences could be extraordinarily dangerous with so many of the potential malefactors being aggressive and armed to the teeth at that. Again, Kevin Freeman, the sort of thing that we prize our ability to assess and learn about from you and your resources, notably, and I'm anxious to hear more about it, your new television product. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would, quickly.
Yes, it's titled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, and it's brought to bring attention to the American people to all the things that are happening. This next war will be a cyber economic war, at least in the beginning, before it becomes a shooting war. We're seeing evidence of it now, and that impacts Americans directly. It impacts their stock holdings. It impacts their bank accounts. So the threat is not just to our physical well-beings. It's a threat to our financial well-beings, and that's going to impact all Americans. We're all, in a sense, soldiers in this battle.
We are indeed. Speaking of the battle, Kevin, one of the new fronts that seems to be opening is one that involves our underseas telecommunications cables. It seems as though there's an increasing capacity and perhaps intention on the part of the Russians and perhaps others to either attack and perhaps destroy those cables or simply tap into them. What are your thoughts on the role of such a, well, capability and program that might be for economic, among other interests of the United States?
Well, it was a couple of years ago that the Russians and Chinese laid their own cables. And I don't have the story in front of me, but I remember talking about it with you. So if you went back in the archives, they were laying their own cables so that if something did happen to the ones that the West owns, that they could continue to function. Well, that was an ominous sign then. It's even more ominous to realize that Russian Navy, particularly submarines, are skulking around all of our cables now, locating them and finding how they could tap in or just destroy. So this is what you would do. You do this kind of warfare. You do space warfare. You do satellite, which would include satellite warfare. You do these things if you were preparing for an attack. And so it's very ominous. And now we have further proof because we've spotted their Navy skulking around the cables.
Yes, we have. Kevin Freeman, again, this is why we turn to you with great enthusiasm each week here at Secure Freedom Radio, and appreciate so much your contributions to the work of the Center for Security Policy as our senior fellow. I am excited about Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman and strongly encourage our listeners to watch this space for that product, as well as, of course, routinely follow your great writings at globaleconomicwarfare.com. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.